2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of the 90th Percentile. This is episode one of season four. We're starting it back up here in 2025. Of course, it is Jeff Ponce alongside me, as always, with my co-host, Matt Pajak, who's now on East Coast time. It's wonderful. You're not recorded with me at 6 o'clock in the morning any longer.
I kind of miss it, honestly. Okay. I miss the 6 a.m. Record, but yeah, turn up or transfer back to the East Coast. That's what I did. I didn't turn up. I turned down, and I transferred back to the East Coast, North Carolina. We got snow out there. It was greeted by 2 inches of snow. Apparently, that's more snow that's accumulated in this part of North Carolina since the entire time I was gone. And, yes, I've already had Bojangles twice since being back in the Eastern Time Zone in the past week. So, for anybody out there who's curious.
Mr. Bojangles. Used to be these late night commercials for Time Warner Music. You're probably too young to remember these, but you'd be watching TV like at like 10 o'clock at night, and they would just have these infomercials for these Time Warner like best music of the 70s set, and they would play certain songs, and Mr. Bojangles was one of the songs. That's the only reason I know the Mr. Bojangles song is because of that commercial. So every time I hear you guys say Bojangles.
Hey, Bo's Nose. I do want to put this out there for all the people listening. I'm sure there is plenty of people that listen to this that know about Bojangles, that love Bojangles, that it's near and dear to their heart. As I was preparing to leave Colorado, we were shared an article, and I don't know how, you know, there was the whole thing about In-N-Out only being in the Southwest and California, Texas, and then like it came to Colorado a couple of years ago, and it was like, yep. Whoa. And now I think it's in Tennessee, like these regional chains going national, right? Bojangles, primarily in the Southeast, mid-Atlantic, Southeast type area of the country. There was an article that came out recently that they're putting two Bojangles chains, I believe it's two, in Pueblo, Colorado, which is like 2 hours south of Denver. It is not, if you've ever been to Colorado, if you've been to Denver, if you've been to Boulder, if you've been to Colorado Springs, Pueblo is way different.
Very yeah.
Different market. But really interesting that Bojangles is getting into Colorado.
Now, is that closer to like the Arizona border?
It's heading in that direction. Okay. You're probably, and it's the New Mexico border.
Okay.
Because you're still on the east side of the Front Range, and
okay,
yeah,
so. Interesting. Well, let's talk about the fact that you entered the transfer portal. You played the last couple of seasons for Deion Sanders, and you're going to play for Bill Belichick. How does that feel?
I mean, it's a treat, honestly. convenient timing. Very excited for UNC football this year.
It's just perfect. You know, Deion's going to go coach the Cowboys, and you're going to go play for Billy. What a season. But we're here to talk about baseball. Today's topic, we started thinking about it as some of our rankings have come out in this offseason. Of course, we have rookie Sasaki, number one, as the top prospect in baseball. The top 100 list just dropped yesterday as we're recording this on Thursday. Our top freshman of the year is Rintaro Sasaki, correct? I said the name right? From Stanford. Top Japanese prospect that came over to the United States and is playing college ball here. That's really unique. We just saw Ichiro Suzuki elected to the Hall of Fame, first Japanese player to be elected to the American, you know, National Baseball Hall of Fame. Congratulations to him, though he was not unanimous. When I vote in a few years, I promise I'll vote for the right guys and will not withhold votes. That is the honor that I've been bestowed upon to potentially be a Hall voter one of these days. So I just want to say that it's changing, guys. The younger voters are coming. We'll have three votes for Baseball America. We had two for the first time this year. Both JJ and Ben Badler voted for Ichiro as well as others. But we got off track a little bit here. Who are the world champions in terms of the WBC? Samurai Japan, right? Go right on through. Olympic champions as well. Pretty much every honor right now belongs to either a Japanese player or a Japanese team. Of course, the best player in the world on the best team, and the best team in the world had three of the biggest Japanese stars, if not the three biggest Japanese stars over here in the States. It's been a run of Japanese dominance. So the question is, why is America falling behind, and are they falling behind? I think that's reasonable to ask as well. So Matt, I'm going to kick it over to you. You're someone who obviously is intimately involved in player development and evaluation on the pro side, amateur side. So talk to me a little bit about what you're noticing, you know, with Japan's development versus America, and we'll peel back the layers on this topic.
Yeah, it's a big onion. It's a big parfait. If you're into parfaits, dated reference. I never thought I would say Shrek would be a dated reference, but I'm sure there's a lot of high school kids out there that are probably like, "Who's Shrek?" There's a lot of different things here, and I don't think it's just America falling behind Japan. We're going to focus on Japan for this pod. I do think that there's other elements to it. You know, even just like the excitement that Latin players bring to the game. You know, circulated this question the other day to a number of different people who work in the game, people who are diehard fans, play fantasy baseball, people who are fans of the game, maybe not in a diehard way, more of a casual fan, but someone who definitely pays attention. Kids circulated this question to kids as well, who enjoy the game of baseball. And the question was, who's the most fun American player right now? Hey, Lane, who's the most fun American player right now? Shohei Ohtani. We said American. Oh, crickets. Ohtani is probably gonna take that if you ask a large span of people who's the funnest player in baseball right now. But when you start to think about, you know, Fernando Tatis is a fun player. Ronald Acuna, when he's healthy, is a fun player. Francisco Lindor is a fun player.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is a fun player.
It's kind of hard to sit here and, you know, I think Bobby Witt's going to be, I mean, he's there. He just, Kansas City's got to get a little bit more national attention. They got to play in some big playoff games. I think Bobby Witt Jr. is there. I think Corbin Carroll is right there as well. But when you're looking at the current American superstar of the past couple of years, Aaron Judge, not a ton of personality there. Plays for the Yankees. The Yankees are always very like straight edge, clean cut. So kind of hard to, I guess, attach fun to Aaron Judge. Kind of hard to attach fun to Mike Trout. Didn't play in very many big games. Also very, you know, clean cut, straight edge, goes about his business. A little bit more machine-like. You know, fantastic baseball players, but just like kind of dry from a personality standpoint. You're sitting here and it's like, all right, America is kind of like falling behind on fun players. Okay. What does that count for? Well, let's just go ahead and roll into a more objective topic. All right. So now that we've established that maybe American players aren't the most fun, you know, I think the top group that was settled on more or less was some combination of Bryce Harper, Mookie Betts, and
Bobby Witt.
But Mookie Betts played half a season last year, and to be completely honest, like playing for that Dodgers super team, I don't want to say he's watered down, but it's a little bit watered down because he doesn't get to shine as much because he's surrounded by and he's dwarfed by Japanese superstar Shohei Ohtani. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the new number one prospect for Baseball America. I'm going to flip this one over to you because you're a huge fan of this guy. I'm a fan of this guy. But yeah, in all of the places where Japan is currently kicking America's ass, the top prospect in baseball is Roki Sasaki.
Yeah, and I think pitching development's a large part of it, right? It's funny because when we sort of dug in on Sasaki back in November, I got access to some data. There was definitely some funky stuff within the numbers. I talked about it at the time. Former colleague of mine, good friend Lance Brozdowski, did a really good video on YouTube. Go check his stuff out, where he kind of broke down some of the inaccuracies within the data. Japan switched to different ball tracking systems. They still don't have consistency in terms of Hawkeye and TrackMan and other things, how some of those things are calibrated. He had like 7 feet of extension. He doesn't really have 7 feet of extension. It's more closer to six. But this is a guy that has dealt with some injuries and still has probably thrown more innings in a competitive environment than a lot of Ironman kind of prospects, right? 100 innings, 120 innings. It's funny because when we start to compare that to Job and some of these other guys that are at the top of the list, it's not all that different, right? And he's dealt with, you know, actual injuries that have kept him off the field consistently. You don't see like the Noah Schultz sort of kid gloves thing where we've never really seen Noah Schultz. I even think dating back to high school, talking to some scouts, get into the fifth or sixth inning at a start. It's just not something that he does. Japanese pitchers tend to throw a lot more. They tend to train differently. They tend to train on movement more frequently than they even get obsessed maybe with pitch design and some of those things. It's more about building the engine and, you know, building the abilities and the skills before these guys kind of get to that final point. And then you see guys like Ohtani and others come over here and start to work with, you know, some pitch development stuff and really take off. If you look at the pitcher that Shohei Ohtani was in 2017 and the guy that we saw in 2023 with the Angels, they were very different players, very different pitchers, you know, different slider, started working in a sinker more. So there are some elements of American development that can push those guys over the edge, but I often feel like we're skipping too many steps in terms of building the athlete, building out the engine. And one of the, you know, I happened to be lucky enough to see two of the Team Japan games in the WBC in person, was there early for media scrum. So I was on the field during BP. I got to watch the pitchers warm up, really paid a lot of attention to some of the stretching that guys like Imanaga and Sasaki were doing. I saw them go back to back in the start. I saw Yamamoto throw. I saw Ohtani, of course, come in. So I saw how they were able to roll these guys out. And there were other pitchers as well that were less known, maybe not guys that would have a ton of success in the major leagues, but an international stage, throw strikes, compete, move pretty well, and understand the art of deception, which is a huge part of, I think, what makes Japanese pitchers unique. So when I start to look at those guys, I look at Sasaki, I look at the fact that he's coming over here, you know, has a golden arm just in terms of insane power that he can generate, you know, from his build, from his arm. There's not a lot of guys outside of Paul Skeens and Harlan Susanna who throw as hard as this guy in pro ball. And now, you know, he's going to be under the tutelage of Dodgers pitching development. We can knock Dodgers pitching development for a lot of guys getting hurt. I would argue that, you know, they're dealing with high performance sports cars. Those cars need more maintenance than, you know, your Toyota does, right? But it can hit a peak that your Toyota can't hit. Your Toyota is not going to get up to 220 miles an hour. It can't take a turn at 110 on a race car track. If you've ever driven a race car, I was lucky enough to do that in Vegas a bunch of years ago in a McLaren. Like, it just feels very different. Even if you've driven fast cars and muscle cars and everything else, you know, like, those cars feel different than, you know, a souped up WRX, right? So I know the analogy's there, but it's like, I think we look at Sasaki, people are at this point like, ah, he's overrated, he's this, he's that. I don't know, man. We've already seen a ton of Japanese players come over here, make adjustments, have success, and it just unlocks that next level. So I think we get so caught up in development, especially in the early stages of development, over the first 10 to 12 years someone's playing the game, of trying to get them to emulate major leaguers as opposed to like teaching them how to move, you know, how to build that base and that foundation so you can then pile those major league skills on top of it once they get to a certain point. I think it's just a different approach. I think it's a much more skills-based approach in Japan, even on the hitting side, than it is here in the States. I don't know what you think about that. You're obviously somebody who looks at athleticism, looks at movers, and, you know, is well-versed in the evaluation of pitchers and hitters.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been to Japan. would love to go someday. Big fan of the culture, for as much of it as I'm familiar with. They are very detail-oriented people. They're very disciplined. And I think, you know, you brought some of that up in terms of how they warmed up when you were able to get on field during media availability and all that. I think what you're probably seeing right now, you know, with players coming over, and it's not just on the pitching side, it's on the hitting side too. It feels like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, like a really good Japanese player wasn't necessarily rare, but it was like there'd be like one. You know, we'd get really excited about Hideki Matsui, and then he'd come over and he'd be a good ball player. But, you know, today it's like, you know, you're almost losing track of where all these good Japanese ball players are playing in the States. You know, you got Suzuki up in Chicago. You got, you know, Yoshida has done nothing but hit since coming to the States, you know, for his defensive shortcomings and whatever else, you know, may potentially impact his playing time there. He has done what he was billed to do, which is come over and hit. You got Murakami. He'll be a big name probably next year for the next cycle coming over. It just feels like there's 1, 2, 3 impact Japanese players coming over almost every year at this point. But yeah, I think it's a testament to how detail oriented they are as a culture, and probably how rigorous their development process is from an early age, which we just do not have here. And maybe at one point we did. I'm not always saying that's a good thing. You know, I think that's a completely different subject if you went deeper in and you looked at the rigor of baseball development in Japan. You know, maybe that's not necessarily what you want to sign up for, but it's working right now. And it's currently working, especially for the size of the country and the amount of athletes that they have compared to the United States. It's working better than what we have going in the United States. And we've talked about it ad nauseum, exposure funnel. I don't think it's necessarily anybody, you know, at the professional or the college level or whatever's fault right now. I just think it's a matter of like, our kids are playing too many games. They're not developing, you know, there aren't disciplined skill development sessions. And I'm not saying that we need to create factories here in the United States for talent development, but I think a lot of things are falling through the cracks with the way that our players come up from youth to high school level. It's just play, get on a plane, go meet your team in Georgia, and then fly back to wherever you are. And these they're not like, it's not team development. It's player showcasing more than anything else. Again, don't want to beat that to death, but I think this is a really good transition too. And unless there's anything else you want to hop on here, past couple of years, world number one in the WBSC rankings, Japan. You just look at the track record and look, this isn't an indictment on USA Baseball, because at the end of the day, USA Baseball's job is to identify and select the best players that they potentially have at their disposal. And we're going to get back into this in a second when we talk about Rintaro. I would just make an argument, you know, straight up that there isn't a great pool to choose from, because at the end of the day, it's selecting an all-star team, trying to get them, you know, ready in a week to play together, and then going and playing against a much more well-oiled machine, if you will. But, you know, at the 18U level, Japan's kind of had the U.S.'s number the past couple of years. The U.S. did get Japan in Florida in 2022 at the Worlds, and then ultimately won gold at those Worlds. But 2023, a year later, lost to Japan and then didn't medal at that Worlds that was not on United States soil. You look at the men's senior national team, have not beat Japan going back to 2019. I believe that was Premier 12. The U.S. beat Japan 4-3 in 2019. Since then, Japan beat the U.S. in the Olympics twice, 7-6, and then in the gold medal game, 2-0. Japan obviously took down United States in the World Baseball Classic 2023, that final game, 3-2 Japan. And then most recently this fall, Premier 12, Japan 9-1. again, at the Premier 12. Now, the Premier 12 has certain challenges associated with it because you're dealing with non-40-man professional players. It's hard to find pitching, especially in November when that tournament goes on. But I really want to cue in here on that 2023 World Baseball Classic, because a lot of people, especially on the American side, were frustrated that you didn't have a Jacob DeGrom, you didn't have, you know, a Justin Verlander, you have a Garrett Cole to kind of like anchor that pitching staff. And I would make an argument that it was a level playing field for that World Baseball Classic final. Yu Darvish was slated to go, you know, as far as everyone could predict. He was rested. He's one of the top names on that Japanese roster from a star power standpoint. Why wouldn't it be Yu Darvish? And they didn't announce their starter until the last second. Ended up being Shota Imanaga, who at the time nobody knew about. Nobody knew anything about Shota Imanaga. We didn't know he was the little left-handed wizard that he became. Fantastic pitcher. He only threw two innings, and it was a little bit of a bullpen game at that point, where it was like one inning stints of not name brand Major League Baseball pitchers on Japan's side shutting down a very high powered United States lineup that had every player that you could ever want to be in that lineup. At the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. So now on the United States pitching side, yeah, there was no Jacob DeGrom, but look, it's not like they threw Shohei Ohtani or Roki Sasaki at you in the gold medal game. They went basically bullpen game, and the United States did the same thing. They started Merrill Kelly, and in a pretty even pitching matchup, you know, at the end of the game, it ended up being Shohei Ohtani blowing away Mike Trout. But the last pitcher in for the United States was Devin Williams. You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like that's like a 4A reliever.
It's the Yankees closer, guys. The New York Yankees closer.
It was a closer for the New York Yankees, you know. anyway, all of that to say, that's the product, that's the result of everything that we're talking about here, is that when ultimately it comes down to international competition, and again, not an indictment on USA baseball, but America is behind just because, you know, the pool of fish to catch it's not great, you know, and unless you haven't, Jeff, you have anything to add specifically on that?
Yeah, I think there's something that I had witnessed in the Cape Cod League in the summer of 2022. It was a Japanese player who had come over, wasn't a huge prospect over there, played JUCO out here, ripped up the Cape, transferred to Oregon. He's in pro ball now. Tiny little guy, 5'6", 150 pounds. His name's Rico Nishida. One of the most fun players I've ever watched in the Cape. He took the Cape by storm. And one of the things that I noticed about Nishida and noticed about certain players in the Japanese roster as well was how well these guys play the game of baseball. And I think there's some element to that. We've gotten so into like this SEC mentality of like slug, throw hard, blow it by everybody. And there's a place for that, man. I love that kind of baseball. I'm not going to deny it. I'm American. But I do think there's some elements with a lot of these Japanese players that maybe they don't have those physical attributes, but they know how to go the other way. They know how to hit it where they ain't. They know how to put pressure on the defense. They're constantly paying attention to little things. That's from training. That's from learning how to be a better base runner. That's from coaching, right? Some of it is certainly innate, but like it is with any of these players. But I think you watch some of these guys and they play the game. They do things that Americans are scared to do, right? They don't want to play like that. We've almost gone too far in like, I hate to use this term, but like in the money ball direction of not giving up bases, not giving up runs, not putting pressure on defenses. And I think like we're seeing now that guys that can do that can be disruptive. Corbin Carroll is kind of like the American player that plays that style. We don't have a lot of those guys, even some of the smaller guys that are speedy. They'd rather add power. They'd rather add bat speed, try to add some impact as opposed to leaning into that Now, I don't know if that's good or bad from getting paid in the open market and the professional element, but I do think when you watch some of these teams, you watch some of these players, that is something that's unique. And Nishida was interesting because he was sort of one of these first Japanese players to kind of come over here. Now, he wasn't a huge prospect like a guy we're about to talk about, Rintaro Sasaki, in a different type of a player. But you do have to wonder if sort of that laid the foundation for him to come over here. So let's get into Sasaki a little bit. He played in the draft league. You know, you have some loose affiliations with the draft league. And talk to me a little bit about that player and what the expectations are. And I think that it speaks volumes. And we talked about this yesterday. I'm kind of stealing your thunder a little bit, that a Japanese player was picked as freshman of the year when we have so many talented players from the high school ranks now going into college ball because there's less pro jobs.
Hey, Jeff, you know, it continues with the theme of this whole pod. And at the end of the day, you just have to remember that your wife's favorite player is probably Japanese. You know, that's true for a lot of people out there, you know. Anyway, transitioning to Rintaro Sasaki. Baseball America preseason freshman of the year. I saw that pop up. Was that last week? I think it was last week. This is third week of January we're in here. But what was interesting to me about this, and this I think ties back into talking about the talent pool that USA Baseball is choosing from to take to these international tournaments. I just think it's a little bit funny that you have one Japanese player in college baseball and he's named the preseason freshman of the year when we have an entire draft class of high school players that just decided to go to college. We can't think of one American that we like better than the one Japanese guy. So it's like, you know, an army of 1,000 versus one, and Rintaro Sasaki gets named preseason freshman of the year. I mean, obviously, you know, you could go look at Baseball America's top 25, you know, college freshmen that they're excited about. There's some really good names on there. But in a lot of the cases, we're not really sure how much playing time any of those guys might get. I mean, I know a guy that I personally really like is Jay Abernathy at Tennessee, but you know, in the current state of Tennessee, you've got Gavin Kylan and Dean Curley, who I believe were both USA Baseball collegiate national team middle infielders last summer. And they just brought in a transfer who I think's on his third school to play third base. And you know, and Abernathy, as I knew him as an amateur, was, you know, a middle infielder. You know, maybe he squeaked some time in the outfield, but their outfield's loaded. They're the defending national champions. They recruit JUCO really well. They recruit the portal really well. They recruit high school really well. I mean, Vitello's built a juggernaut of a roster, and the player that is going to help him win baseball games is going to go out there and play, whether that's, you know, that's a rabbit hole, tangent, whatever the point. The point is that we're talking about preseason freshman of the year. It's the one Japanese player in all of college baseball. And we're talking about the number one prospect in all of baseball, and it's Roki Sasaki, and it's, you know, he's a Japanese player. We're talking about who's the number one baseball country in the world. We're talking about Japan. Who won the World Baseball Classic? Japan. You know, who won the MVP last year in Major League Baseball? Shohei Ohtani, Japanese. You know, he's the biggest superstar in the game right now. You know, before Juan Soto signed that contract, biggest contract, Shohei Ohtani. Well, Juan Soto is great, but he also just lost the World Series to Shohei Ohtani. And the Los Angeles Dodgers did it with Ohtani, their MVP, and Yamamoto being a very important part of that rotation, because it was a little bit like a war of attrition for the Dodgers last year. And Yamamoto ended up being the guy they needed probably the most. And he went out there and he performed capably, and they won the World Series. And then Roki Sasaki is a Dodger now. So more or less, that's the point. Rintaro Sasaki, I think, is a really exciting young player. I think he's going to mash. We're going to see him in the ACC this year, which is going to be really weird. Stanford in the Atlantic Coast Conference. but even if you looked at not just this year's freshman class, go back and look at last year's freshman class. Sasaki's probably the preseason freshman of the year in last year's class. He might be the preseason freshman of the year in the class before that. Like there's that much buzz around Rintaro Sasaki being here in the States. And I think that's the one hand. On the other hand, there just isn't an American freshman that we're all that excited about or that we've been all that excited about for a couple of years now.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, who was the highest profile freshman to get onto campus this year? Was it Schmidt with LSU, just in terms of where he ranked in draft rankings? I mean, we weigh your opinion on where he should have gone or not, but it's mostly like some of these bigger pitchers that may end up like not even, we'll see, but might end up like pitching out of the bullpen. Like there's a lot of these freshman pitchers that maybe spend a year doing some bullpen starts, maybe doing some long work, maybe pitching in midweek games against lesser competition. It's kind of what Leiter did as a freshman, right? Like, and he was a fairly highly touted freshman. You know, there aren't a whole lot of like Kumar Rockers and those guys. It feels like it's the bigger names on that side. And then we often see who gets to campus and who pops. I mean, so often the best freshman in the class might end up at a mid-major and then end up in the portal after his first season and end up at a bigger school. It seems like the dynamics have changed and it's become maybe a little bit more like pro ball where the reputation doesn't earn you immediacy in terms of a starting role at a big school. You kind of got to earn it. And maybe that's good. Maybe it's bad. But I think it also kind of shows you where we're at, where maybe there's some ambiguity among some of these top prospects that it's like we've seen this over and over again. You know, who is the true standout that, you know, is going to go out there and be an impact player on, you know, both sides of the ball. And I'm not sure that we have those all the time. There's a lot of questions, even with the top college hitters at this point in time of, you know, does this guy have enough impact to really be, you know, a better than a 50 or a 45 really once he gets to pro ball. And we've seen, I mean, we did a whole podcast on it. The success rate on top of the draft college hitters has probably never been worse.
Right. And I'm just thinking back and maybe you've got a better name than this in the past 3, 4, or 5 years of an American freshman, American position player who was a freshman getting to a college campus, who potentially would have been named. I'm putting you on the spot, but I got a name and I'll say mine first. It gives you a few more seconds. Who potentially could have been named preseason freshman of the year over Rintaro Sasaki in any of the last 4 or 5 years. And the only one that really pops into my head is like, yeah, he probably had the name recognition and then he backed it up was Dylan Cruz.
I was going to say that. Yeah. I think that's the name, right? You talk about some hype going into that draft, 5-round draft. So there were some circumstances that, you know, maybe a team didn't free up money to sign him or the money that was needed to sign him, gets the campus, produces all 3 years, is a really impactful player on both sides of the ball, does everything really well. And he was so unusual. Like he was in this class where other guys did get drafted and did get money. And he just kind of had a down summer showcase circuit and teams wouldn't meet the asking price. I think you look back on that draft, a lot of teams should have paid Dylan Cruz, you know? And we could talk about, you know, whether spending 3 years at LSU, what that did for his development. We've talked about that on previous shows. I think you're right. I think that's probably the only one that we can point to as, you know, a hyped up freshman that delivered. I guess Tommy White, maybe a little bit in that conversation. He's a similar player to Rintaro Sasaki, you know, and obviously put up a...
But I would make the argument that until Tommy White hit 36 home runs in his first week of college baseball, he probably wouldn't have been.
I mean, he was covering the draft at the time. He was definitely known, you know.
He was touted.
But it wasn't a first rounder. Like, I think there were still people who had first round grades on Dylan Crews.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, again, going back to like Jay Abernathy and a lot of, you know, some of this is just the product of the times, right? Like, you guys are picking Rentaro Sasaki's preseason freshman of the year. Makes sense. He's in a place. One, he you know, he got to choose where he was going to go. He wanted to go somewhere. Academics were important. And, you know, obviously there's NIL money attached to it in some capacity, but he's going to go to Stanford and like, this is your spot and you're going to play. And if you struggle, you're still going to play. And if you succeed, you're going to play and you're going to play. I like Jay Abernathy. A couple years ago, before transfer portal and NIL and all of that, Christian Moore gets drafted in the top 10 by the Angels. Dean Curley is your shortstop. And Jay Abernathy comes in as a freshman and he plays second base. And now it's like, all right, you know, Billy Amick out, Christian Moore out at second and third. Insert, you know, 3 or 4 year college player at third base and Gavin Kylan, you know, to be at second base. And you're sitting here and you're like, okay, so it's hard to name Jay Abernathy preseason freshman of the year because you don't even know if he's going to play. He's definitely not going to play the position that he was recruited to come into play as a freshman, unless someone gets hurt, which we hope doesn't happen. Okay. And then another one that I really like that I would say, you know, potentially has the exciting tools and flashed in the fall to be able to potentially be in consideration for preseason freshman of the year is Hunter Carnes. And we don't even know if he's going to catch. We don't know if he's going to play his position because he's on another team that is slated to make a run at Omaha who has a veteran catcher that's in front of him. So, like, these exciting freshmen are getting to campus at these higher-profile schools that have NIL money, that have the ability to go into the portal and pull players. And they're kind of just, like you said before, you're not seeing the field unless you're earning that spot on the field. And oftentimes, as a freshman, you're earning that spot on the field at not the position you were recruited to come in and play. That's a completely different conversation, but another reason, secondarily, auxiliary, not a word, that America's falling behind is that we're not taking as many high school players in the draft. It's a dwindling number. Baseball America has done the numbers on this. You can go see the article on it. Fewer high school players getting selected in the draft. The higher profile ones that are making it to campus are not getting the preferential treatment and the red carpet and the carte blanche that they had 3 or 4 years ago. And again, I will beat this drum until probably the day that I'm under the ground, which is hopefully a long time from now, but it is killing the pro pipeline. It really is, you know, and that may be extreme. People may, you know, listen to this and they might, oh, that Matt Pajak, he's extreme, but look, the NCAA keeps changing rules. They keep extending eligibility. They keep saying you can do this with the transfer portal. There's no caps on NIL. You know, JUCO, pretty soon it sounds like 2 years of JUCO are not going to count against your eligibility. College baseball is going to become the third level of professional baseball in, if it hasn't already, in the United States. You're going to have ball, indie ball, college ball, and it's going to be a bunch of 24 and 25 year old dudes who have no pro prospects, no affiliated pro prospects, battling it out to get to Omaha. And what are we doing about our 18 and 19 year olds? What are we doing about our talented 18 and 19 year olds that need to play to develop? Because look, Jeff, we know the demographics of baseball players in this country. Most of them are white. Most of them have money. It just is what it is. And for most kids that come from that demographic, if you give them the choice between going and playing at a JUCO and going to a four-year school and getting an education, there's a lot of them hanging the spikes up. It takes a special person, and I, I it's it's not, we're not knocking JUCO, but it takes a special person who loves the game to take that bet on themselves to go to a junior college and to go through that grind for a year, especially when you have another option, that other option being, yeah, I'm just going to go to school and I'm going to get a business degree.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you're not incorrect on that. And when the opportunities are there, I think, you know, it's also one of those things where I heard someone, this is a, kind of a bad analogy, but I heard Joe Kelly yesterday kind of talking about a salary cap or a salary floor and why it's not going to work in baseball, particularly with Japanese players. Because if you go and Google places to visit, nice places to visit in the United States, like Milwaukee is not coming up, right? you know, Tampa's probably maybe not coming up. You know, some of those, Cleveland isn't coming up. So when all things are equal, if a team can is capped at what they can pay Shohei Ohtani or pay Roki Sasaki, they're still going to go to LA. They're still going to go to New York. And I think it's the same thing with college baseball, where there's NIL money. You know, a guy is going to look at that. He's going to look at the benefits of putting on that LSU uniform and all the peripheral stuff he gets, right? Yes. Beyond even playing the game, beyond the notoriety, right? It's just on campus, you're a big deal, you're a big freshman, right? Like meeting girls, all that sort of stuff. We can't deny that that's all part of it, right? What kind of a guy is going to say, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go play at Elon. I'm going to go play JUCO. There's not a lot of guys that are going to make that choice. They're going to bet on themselves, and I don't blame them. And it might put them behind the eight ball for a couple of years, right? It actually might hurt them from a development standpoint, where you're not necessarily seeing that in Japan. I also think that, you know, we can even get down and, you know, we'll wrap this up soon, but I think we can even get down to the root level. My understanding of the way that rec baseball more or less works in Japan is it's more like local academies, that you kind of go here, you learn how to play. It's not organized in the sense that it's organized with us, where like in my town, everybody's put onto a team. We all practice separately. We all might learn different skills. Some guy might have a better coach than another guy, where if it was more streamlined, especially in those early years, in terms of teaching guys skills, teaching guys how to hit, how to make contact, how to throw strikes more consistently, you know, how to move, even how to field the ground ball, where to throw, like all that stuff takes so many years for kids to learn that they're 11 or 12 when they finally figure it out. And they've been playing baseball for 6 years. I think some of it is that, and we look at, you know, the Dominican Republic, we look at Venezuela, there are academies, there's a lot of training. There's also a lot of free play with those guys, which are two things that we sort of don't have. We don't have, like, we have a loose structure, so we don't have maybe enough structure, or we have too much structure, right? We kind of play in the middle and try to kind of do both sides, and it doesn't work. And in the end, it's just, we've gotten so obsessed with not being a participation trophy, like, that we forget about learning the game, having fun, and having a desire to show up and work hard is really the foundation of all this. Like, my oldest son didn't enjoy baseball. How I approached it with my youngest son was very different, and he enjoys sports. He enjoys playing baseball. He enjoys doing the work, you know, even if he doesn't hit, or he has a bad game, or, you know, he swings through a bunch of pitches and, you know, a given BP or something like that. He still wants to go back to the cage and work. And I think that's a big part of it, is we haven't taught these kids that, like, you can get better by putting in the work and putting in the time, and your passion and enjoyment to play this game, should override your natural God-given talents. And I think that's a problem. And these aren't even necessarily pro players, but I think what it does is it lessens the competition level. You know, when you teach kids that they shouldn't compete, even if someone is significantly better than them, somebody shouldn't play with passion and desire to win and to get better. You know, there's too many guys that we want to roll out there now as like tackle dummies for the good kids. And I think that that's also hurting the game in some way, shape, and form. And I don't think that in other countries that it's approached that way necessarily. I don't think that in Japan they're stopping guys from playing baseball at 10 years old, you know, And we do that here. We do. We eliminate athletes in baseball earlier than we do in other sports. Football players, there's football players that don't play football until they're 14 years old. And then, you know, play Division I football and go in the top four rounds of the NFL draft. I mean, we have Hall of Famers that didn't play until they were in high school. Teddy Bruschi didn't play, was in the high school band his first 2 years in high school, and then learned how to play football. You know, it's the only sport where we eliminate athletes. Rec basketball is much better about providing opportunities for kids to play basketball throughout their life, even if they're not great players, even if they're not varsity caliber basketball players. You can go and play in a league until you're 60 years old, you know? And I think that's hockey's kind of the same way too. Baseball's the only one where we just tell them, nope, you're not good enough. You can't even play the sport anymore. There's no opportunities for you to play. And I think that's a big part of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a completely different subsection of this, but I think, to be concise, America is falling behind for two reasons. One, the talent identification process, which you just outlined, but then also the development process, which you also just touched on as well. Something that I've seen at the youth level is a lot of the American players they're drilling reps, but they're very, they're on script and they don't know how to react to the game, right? So when they're taking ground balls, like, they take a ground ball, they throw it to first base. And they're drilling this very on script of, this is what happens when I get a ground ball. But then when player introduces a little bit of chaos, maybe instead of running through the first base bag and they run to second base, it's like the entire foundation of the house just collapses. And these kids that can feel the ground ball and throw the ball to first base suddenly have no idea what the objective is as this guy turns and runs to second base. Right. And I think that's getting back to Japan. They're really smart baseball players because they learn the game. Like there's two sides to it. There's like, you got to play the game, but then you also have to like go learn the game, go learn the rules. How do you learn the rules? You play MLB The Show, you play, or you watch pro baseball, you watch college baseball. And I don't know how much, I don't know who I would recommend. I mean, if you're in California, I would recommend going to see UC Irvine, you know, but you know, to your point earlier, it's like, okay, realistically, do we really want kids watching college baseball to learn the game of baseball right now? Because it's a lot of just MASH and, you know, OBP, Moneyball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the last point that I want to make, which again, it goes back to the talent identification thing, America's falling behind, is just that I lost it. I lost the point that I was going to make. You guys are missing out on a really good point.
Well, while you think about it, I think, you know, one of the points you're making is like players in America are not situationally coached. These kids are so sort of out of sorts when there is any chaos introduced because they're never sort of coached on anything but like go in the cage and hit this target. You know, we'll do the relay drill 1,000 times. We'll do a very basic infield where everybody's throwing to first base, where, you know, they never just kind of bring the guys into the field and say, hey, you're at second, you know, you're at shortstop, you're at first base. What happens if we have a base runner that does this, right? And I think like that's the stuff that can make a lot of the difference. And I think, you know, when we talk about Japanese players playing the game better, I think they're better situational players than Americans are and can read, you know, mistakes and know what to do with that in an instant because it's innate. It's drilled into them, you know, versus, you know, having to figure it out and getting caught. Like, I don't see a lot of Japanese players getting caught in between, you know, second and third base in a rundown, because whatever the decision they're going to make, the ball gets bobbled in the outfield. They're going hard to third base, you know, or they're staying at second because they don't have enough space. Like, I think when I watched, you know, Nishida, that was something that I definitely noticed. And he put a lot of pressure on American players and, you know, it was just a pest. There's some element to that that I think is missing. So hopefully you figured out your point before we wrap this up.
Yeah, I brought it back. So you went a little bit deeper on development, and I'm going to go back to talent pipeline just because this has been the hair across my ass for months. All right. Heard yesterday, 14 SEC schools this year will be operating with a $3 million roster. And I heard a couple of high-profile ACC programs will be operating around $750K. That's a pretty steep drop-off. Pretty steep drop off. You can still compete with that. I think they're trying to get more in that million range, right? So if you're genuinely curious of what college baseball teams are operating with NIL standpoint, there you go. 14 in the SEC will be around 3 million this year. The top of the ACC feels like it's somewhere between, you know, 750K and like 1.5 million. Okay. I could be off, you know, maybe Wake Forest has more than that. You know, maybe not. Maybe they're more, you know, in that 1 to 1.5 million. But if you're trying to get an idea of what we're actually talking about here in terms of the pipeline, okay. So now let's take this situation. You're a kid, and you just decommitted from a big school that can pay you a lot of money, an SEC school. Different SEC school wants you, so they bring you in. And then a different SEC school, as soon as you get on that campus, is like, oh, they're only offering you 50K. We'll give you 100. And he goes back to the SEC school that he committed to, and he says, hey, I'm getting poked by this other SEC school. They want to give me 100K. If you give me 100K, I'll stay here. And then they do, because they have that money. I mean, that dude's probably not even going to play at any of those, the school that dropped him, the school that picked him up, or the school that was trying to pull him away from the other school. Right. So he's in a situation now where he's a 18, 19 year old. He's getting paid 100K, and he's going to ride the bus. He's going to ride the plane. He's going to have all the perks. He's going to get all the gear. He's probably going to go to Omaha. I don't know if probably he's going to go. There's a good chance he's going to go to Omaha because the team that he's on went to Omaha last year. Cool. The team that wanted him also went to Omaha last year. Cool, right? That dude could be at over 200 different Division I schools in this country and play and be the man as a freshman. Because, yes, there are that many Division I baseball programs, could play and be the man. There's a chance that he doesn't play this year because he's not a 300K player. He's a 100K player, Jeff. He's a 100K player. But are you going to tell that kid, when his choices are go somewhere and get a free education and no NIL money and play right away, or go to this SEC school, get 100K, and you might not see the field? You going to tell that kid not to take the 100K? We're making these college kids fat and happy too early. And that's another factor that's going to clog this pipeline, because that kid could potentially be a pro, but his trajectory might be like, okay, I'm going to bank 100K at this SEC school this year. Doesn't play because he's not ready. And then he goes into another year next year where maybe he sticks around for one more year, doesn't play. And then before you know it, by the time he's worked his way through three other schools, he has banked money, which is more money than most guys make playing baseball in their entire life. And he is now aged out. He's aged out of pro ball models. So now he's performing as a 24-year-old on his third school with his fifth year of eligibility, whatever it is. And by the time he's finally gotten to a place where he's an attractive performer to a pro club, he's 24 or 25 years old, and those guys do not get drafted or signed into affiliated baseball. And that's my hypothetical for how America continues to fall behind. Talent identification, development, youth level, high school level, travel ball, college. It's a little bit disgusting. Japan's going to continue. You know, the freight train of Japan, it's come hard the past couple of years, and
it is going to keep coming hard. Pause.
Pause. No ditty. Yeah, I think to kind of wrap this up and put a bow on it, you know, we don't have all the answers, Sway, but we're just asking.
You ain't got the answers, Sway.
But we're just asking questions. We're trying to figure some of this out as well. You know, we're people that, you know, love baseball, love this country, want to see us, strive and succeed and see our players do well. You know, I'm a dad. Matt's getting up on that train pretty soon, I'm sure. So yeah, I think it's all something that can be fixed and just a matter of, you know, changing the direction a little bit. But
I want to see the United States beat Japan in the World Baseball Classic. I want to see it.
Yes.
I love Japanese players. I love the way they play the game. Yes, they're fun, like all of those things, but it's getting to a point where it's like, I need Bobby Witt and Corbin Carroll and Gunnar Henderson to emerge and just take the torch and be American superstars. It's the same thing over in the NBA, Jeff, and we're not going to extend this any further than we have to, but all of the best players in the NBA aren't American. The American superstars in these leagues that have a number of different international players involved, these world leagues, like the American superstar is dying.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true, though. We have a couple of New England boys coming to save everybody in Cooper Flagg and AJ. I'm not going to even try to say his last name. DeBensta, that's going to BYU. He's a Brockton guy. Shout out Southeastern Massachusetts. Shout out the gritty part of Mass. It's where I'm from. So, you know, I got to show him some love. But this has been another episode of the 90th Percentile. I am Jeff Ponce. That's Matt Pajak. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to have more episodes coming for you.